Theosophical Society in America presents the Eternal Quest radio series with thought-provoking questions on such topics as expansion of awareness, thought power, conquest of illusions, and much more. Our program today deals with the subject of Approaches to Meditation, a book edited by Virginia Hansen.
Meditation. Often the very word itself conjures up pictures of the solitary individual seated in the lotus posture, eyes closed, a smile of utter tranquility upon his face, oblivious of all outer events, or of groups of wild-eyed young people sitting in incense-filled rooms chanting Sanskrit incantations. Neither picture, of course, is an accurate view of meditation. Although the act of meditation may occur any time, anywhere, alone or in a crowd, what is important is not the place or the posture, but rather a certain habitual attitude, or what one writer has called the disposition of the soul. For meditation, which the Quaker writer Bradford Smith defines as the inward art, has to do with oneself, with the self one is or the self one hopes to become. A study of all of the techniques in the world, an examination of meditation systems of the Eastern and Western religions and philosophies, a reading of texts and manuals, however authoritative, will not constitute the act of meditation or induce the meditative spirit. One brings only oneself to the act, whether one is alone or in a group. Whatever discipline is chosen, one is on one's own. A journey may be undertaken in many ways, but the choice of the conveyance is a very personal one, and when it is made, there are certain inevitable consequences. Some people just do not wish to fly. Others will do anything in the world to avoid walking, even to the corner drugstore. But when the decision has been to walk, little is gained by complaining that the road has a lot of rocks in it to bruise one's feet. Since each brings only himself to the journey, whatever conveyance is chosen, it is useful to look at the self one has brought. For our view of ourselves will have a great deal to do with what happens to us on the trip, as well as with what kind of journey we undertake. When someone asks, "Why meditate?" the only answer really is, "Because I want to." Of course, there may be an infinite number of factors involved in this wanting, which is the decision reached by a consciousness called I. But ultimately, all of these factors coalesce in the moment when we say, whether to ourselves or to others does not matter, "I intend to meditate." We may have reasoned in advance that meditation is good for us, that it will lead to certain insights, or we hope it will, that it seems to have benefited others, and that, in any event, it is not likely to cost us very much in time or energy. Or we may act upon a conviction that there is beyond all the ephemeral and phenomenal paraphernalia of the external world a realm of reality which can be known and experienced, that this realm of reality holds within it all the causes from which the phenomenal is born, while yet remaining impartible and unitary, and further, that there is therefore a consciousness or the possibility of a consciousness which can embrace that realm.
The intention to meditate, then, precedes the act. But meditation is less an act than an art. It is not performance, but awareness. We may do a great many things, whether that doing be physical, such as the postures of some schools of meditative yoga, or mental, such as exercising the mind by concentration, imagination, etc. Whatever we do has a bearing upon our meditation, but only when one comes to oneself, in the totality of the self, has one engaged in meditation. Perhaps the paradox is that then we are no longer aware that we are meditating. We simply are. In such a state of awareness, one does not say, "See, I'm meditating." One is oneself, wholly, purely, without division. So meditation is not merely the harnessing of one's mind, although the mental processes may need to be reined in, controlled, directed. It is not just the stilling of emotional reactions, nor only the relaxation of the physical vehicle. All of these tasks may prepare us for meditation, may be helps along the way, may be essential if we are to get on with the discovery of ourselves. Meditation is the art of being, an art to be practiced everywhere, continuously, whether alone or with others. And if one were to describe the art more closely, it might be called the art of being self-recollected. For it is the collection or recollection of the scattered fragments of the self, immersed in the 10,000 things of the world, into the brilliant, all-embracing light of the self in the glory of its oneness. The simplest idea to be had about meditation is that it opens the way for soul action. Since the term soul may be objected to because of its connotations and vagueness of definition, our first step is to clarify what is meant by the word soul. Theosophy is especially helpful with its definite delineation in experiential terms of the domains of consciousness that compose man's immortal selfhood. Specifically, the three regions are manas, which reflects the universal mind, buddhi, the all-inclusive energy of pure love, and Atma, where the deep center of the self is radiated with the mystery and power of life's creative source. Accordingly, man's soul is a triune composite of elements located in these levels of consciousness, a unit that is ever resplendent with its divine nature and potentials.
Meditation, for the student of theosophy, then, becomes a method that accomplishes a polar reversal, or reorientation of one's consciousness from its age-old anchorage in matter, subject to the awesome suction into black depths, to that primordial pole star, one's spiritual center in life's very source. The more clearly the method used is based upon universal principles, and that knowledge, knowing which all else can be known, the more certainly meditation becomes a spiritual science. But it is a new kind of science that is characterized by its unique relevance rather than by its repeatable sameness. While the same vistas and forces are opened by individual explorers, each does so from his own position in time and space, and with results that are unique. The factor of uniqueness upholds, rather than discredits, the validity of individual discoveries. In this light, meditation appears to be more an art than a science. And as with artists, each seeker sets forth on his own responsibility to discover reality and truth, and through endless defeats and triumphs to open a channel for his flow of soul. What must be sought is an alignment or rapport of both body and soul with the yet deeper center of self in its own profound levels of imperishable spirit. Effective meditation is designed to meet this need. It becomes a creative performance involving the whole known self. No art or technology becomes such without a period of special preparation. This applies equally to meditation. The structure of one's daily habits becomes required study and offers also a field of training. Destructive habits are breeders of delusion and doubt that so easily deflect the tentative seekers. If we are serious about meditation, we are actually proposing to bridge the gulf between our visible mundane existence and the invisible, intangible mystery of the soul. Normally, one hardly recognizes the soul's reality, but we intend now to establish far more than a mere nodding acquaintance with it. Cleanliness of life, purity of the mind, and a certain harmlessness of the heart are valuable companions along the way. In fact, they accompany us as a mounted guard, so to speak, in the crowded lanes of inner space that are often anything but benign.
Turning now to performance, creative suggestions are preferable to offering set patterns on how to meditate. We want to make use of our forces by establishing functional routines, such as, for example, sitting in a comfortable arrangement of the physical body. managing an unharried atmosphere in which to attain quietness of mind and harmony of emotions. Employment may be made of music, incense, or any assistance that is available that will aid in bringing full concentration to the task ahead. Clarity as to what we intend to do is a basic need. Attention must move onward, ahead of any distraction that might result from physical discomfort, astral fantasies, or mind-wandering tendencies that may readily overtake and defeat us. Our course must rise steadfastly into that higher orbit of being, the soul, redolent with its own fresh energies to draw upon. This will not happen if we have not, first of all, rendered the physical body with its usual distresses and impulses quietly non-disturbing. As we succeed in doing this, we must know what comes next and go on, or we will certainly go to sleep. There are two facilities available to everyone that can be successfully utilized in moving onward. They are the breath and the inner light. Breathing can be a primary energizer of the bodies, especially if we conceive the universe to be a shoreless ocean of light and energy that is inexhaustible in subtler levels of consciousness where we, too, have our roots. As we breathe deeply, with full concentration upon the breath being drawn from the sea of universal light, down through the mental, astral, and physical bodies, we can visualize it as some clean shower of in-breathed potencies that radiate throughout the whole physical body, harmonizing it. Then, with the out-breathing, we can further render the physical body perfectly still. This effort will be found to have a beneficial effect in quieting the nerves and removing attention from disturbing stresses and discomforts.
Regard well the idea of the inner light, for we may have failed to note the fact that it is manipulable by the will in man. The first manifestation in universal creation is light, and light is the last energy to withdraw. The energy that is the universal light is known by the Sanskrit term prana, which means breath of life. When we are using the breath, as suggested above, we are breathing prana from higher regions. We can visualize it as the light breathed into and radiating from that physical center, which can be pictured as a miniature sun within one's own bodily universe. With the foregoing effort, it is possible to realize our whole physical body as light itself, which, in the final atomic analysis, it actually is. In its archetypal perfection, the physical body is one of nature's most beautiful forms. Rather than thinking of its repellent features and of abandoning it in order to reach higher consciousness, an objective can be to expose the body to the light of its archetypal perfection that actually exists in the deep center of our being. As we do so, we will be acting in harmony with nature's gradual transformation of all physical forms as evolution proceeds. For more information, may we suggest the following books. Approaches to Meditation, edited by Virginia Hansen. Finding the Quiet Mind by Robert Elwood. And Concentration, an Approach to Meditation by Ernest Wood.
The Theosophical Society in America welcomes your inquiries on this and other related subjects toll-free at 1-800-654-9429. That's 1-800-654-9429. Or you may write to the Theosophical Society in America, P.O. Box 270, Wheaton, Illinois, zip code 60189. The toll-free number once again is 1-800-654-9429. Thank you. The Theosophical Society in America presents the Eternal Quest radio series, with thought-provoking questions on such topics as expansion of awareness, thought power, conquest of illusions, and much more. Our program today deals with the subject of concentration, an approach to meditation.
Do you desire success in life? Will you take the means that infallibly secure it? Will you choose and say to yourself, I will have wealth, I will have fame, I will have virtue, I will have power? Let your imagination play upon the thought, and watch the dim clouds of hope shape themselves into heavenly possibilities. Give wings to your fancy, for fairer than any picture that you can paint with thought is the future that you can claim with will. Once you have imagined, once you have chosen, say, I will. And there is nothing on earth that can hinder you for long, for you are immortal, and the future is obedient to you. You say that death may stand in your way? It will not. You say that poverty and sickness and friends may stand in your way? They certainly will not. Nothing can unless you permit it or even make it so. But you must choose, and never again must you wish for anything. But you must say, I will. And you must say it always in thought and in deed, not only now in word. And henceforth, never for a moment must your purpose change, but your constant intention must turn everything you touch into line with it. Then, if that which you have chosen is not harmful, it will be yours before long. But whatever you choose, one thing you will need in all things and at all times, concentration of purpose, of thought, of feeling, of action, so that this, like a powerful magnet, will polarize everything with which you deal.
The Epicurean of old concentrated his mind upon the present and tried to live in accord with natural laws. He did not allow his mind to dwell with regret upon anything past, nor to have fears or anxieties for the future. The Stoic fixed his attention upon the things which lay in his control, refusing to be disturbed by anything that lay outside his power and purpose, or to waste thought and feeling upon it. The Platonist strove to fix his mind with reverent inquiry upon the mysteries of life. Patanjali, the great master of Indian yoga, declared that man could come to his own true state only by the successful practice of complete control of mind. The religious devotee strives, by filling his life and surroundings with ceremonies and symbols, and by constantly repeating in thought the names of God, to stimulate his mind to ever stronger and stronger devotional feelings. The successful man of knowledge is so intent upon his purpose that he finds instruction in the most trifling things that he meets. Such is the power of mind that with its aid all things can be bent to our purpose, and such is the power of man that he can bend the mind to his will. Do we not find that indecision, trepidation, anxiety, and worry give rise to bodily ills, weakness, indigestion, and sleeplessness? Even in these small matters, regular practice of control of mind in a simple form, acts like a magic cure. It is the best means of escape from envy, jealousy, resentment, discontent, delusion, self-deception, pride, anger, and fear. Without it, the building of character cannot be carried on, and with it, it cannot fail.
The literature of religion is full of instances of remarkably extended vision of unseen things attained by the rapt mind. Indian yogis enumerate 8 sets of faculties and powers, including vision of the absent, the past, and the future, psychic telephony, telescopy, and microscopy, the power of traveling invisibly in the subtle body, and others, all attainable by concentration. Marvelous as these effects are, and fascinating as are the study and practice of them to many, they present only one of the developments through concentration. In another direction, many thinkers look upon these as small matters in comparison with the discovery of the God within us, and declare that we need only to find the place of peace within ourselves to achieve the fulfillment of human life. They too extol concentration as the means. Thus, thousands of people all over the world are now turning to the practice of concentration as a first step toward new developments in human life, of which man himself, not his environment, will be the cause. In every case, concentration does not mean a narrowing, limiting, or confining of our thoughts and activities, nor any loss of human sympathies and interests. It does not mean retiring to the forest or the cave, with the wine of life run dry in our veins like a desert river in the summer drought. It does mean that the whole of our life becomes polarized to a chosen purpose, animated by increased powers of thought, love and will, and inspired with a higher self than we have known before.
Sit down quietly and comfortably, and very slowly and gently bring your attention to a particular thing and watch what happens. A procession of mind pictures begins. Such is the mental process when the driver is not there. The car goes along a road, but not of one's conscious present choice. Now, stop thinking about me. Select your own object, look at it, then close your eyes and watch for yourself within your own mind the drift of mental pictures and ideas. Do this several times with different objects. Then observe that you can stop the drift by stepping into the stream and directing it. To do this, you have to pounce upon one of the objects in the drift. You hold it and see what you can do with it. From this mental experiment, you will get a new sense of power, which is the power of concentration, operated by the will. You will also get a new knowledge and experience of I. A third gain is that you will have learned how to think. To command the mind is one thing. To teach it as a willing and happy pupil, constantly finding new delights of experience in healthy functioning, is quite another. And also the natural way of mind living, in which thought and love and will all function harmoniously as one, relating us with understanding and all-over purpose to events and our fellow beings and the wellspring of divine purpose that brings order and joy from the within of our lives is best. Thus, our lives will blossom like the rose, whose beauty and fragrance come from its secret depths, which does not battle for power, which cannot be chiseled or hammered into shape, yet fulfills itself in yielding its best to its order of society, its own circle of living beings. Truly can it be said of such a life that it tells us of fulfillment, harmony, happiness, and faith, and in its gracious yielding to the order of its being, there is a spiritual consummation.
There are great advantages in settling down very quietly into your period of practice, and launching yourself gently into concentration or thought as you would float a little paper boat upon a pond, for it prevents the adoption of any tension of mind or body. It is advisable to cultivate a definite posture for your formal meditations, although you may also practice them at odd times in any position in which you may find yourself, for example, in train or bus, in the garden, or on the beach, or on a couch, or in bed. The advantage of having a regular way of sitting is that you develop the necessary muscles for it by practice and habit, so that you can sit for a long time without bodily tiredness. The object is not to relax the body completely, but to acquire a degree of development of the muscles used in a particular mode of sitting, such that you can remain for a long time in that position without tiring, just as a soldier learns to stand at attention for a long time on certain parades. At first, the body will ache, but that does not matter. Choose your posture and adhere to it, and the aches will pass away. In concentration, there should be no special feeling in the body at all. Let me say a word about the eyes. Practice throwing them out of focus in preparation for your concentration. Otherwise, when you imagine the object as being in its usual position, a short distance in front of you, even when closed, your eyes may focus themselves and perhaps strain themselves to some extent. When we read in old books that in meditation the eyes should be fixed on the tip of the nose, we should reflect that this meant originally straight in front or in the direction in which the nose is pointing, which means that the eyes would be parallel and out of focus.
I will give a special exercise in unfocusing the eyes, which you can practice at any odd times, to get away from any danger of eye strain in the course of your practice of concentration. Stand or sit in front of a vertical mirror, about 1 foot away from it. Look at a spot between your own eyebrows. Your eyes will be focused to that spot. Now, try to look into each eye with each eye, first separately and then both together, so that they are parallel, holding a sheet of cardboard vertically between them, if necessary, in the beginning. Notice also that when you think of something such as a distant scene or an abstract idea in memory, your eyes also take on this condition. Practice this until, before you begin to concentrate upon an object, you can feel that you are not focusing your eyes.
The development of attention on any object follows a triple course. First, I am not interested. In this, there is a sort of sluggishness. We are not interested in things as such. The elementary man and the animal take very little notice of things unless they have been acted upon by them in some way producing pleasure and pain. Their minds have to be stung into action from without, or to satisfy the pangs of a physical hunger that arises inside the body. Second, I am interested because I like it, or I am interested because I dislike it. In the former case, there is a memory of pleasure along with the past experience of the object. In the latter, a memory of pain. Third, I am interested because I want to understand the nature, qualities, and functions of this object. We view it now without the bias of pleasure and pain, setting those aside to attain correct understanding. Thus, in concentration, we have to put aside our likes and dislikes, and especially so in meditation, because we want the truth, which can only be seen in a calm appraisal beyond the turbulence of liking and disliking. For more information, may we suggest the following books: Concentration, An Approach to Meditation by Ernest Wood, The Ancient Wisdom by Annie Besant, and Finding the Quiet Mind by Robert Elwood.
The Theosophical Society in America welcomes your inquiries on this and other related subjects toll-free at 1-800-654-9429. That's 1-800-654-9429. Or you may write to the Theosophical Society in America, P.O. Box 270, Wheaton, Illinois. Zip code 60189-0270. The toll-free number once again is 1-800-654-9429.
The Theosophical Society in America presents the Eternal Quest radio series with thought-provoking questions on such topics as expansion of awareness, thought power, conquest of illusions, past lifetimes, and much more. Our program today deals with the subject of The Art of Inner Listening, a book by Jesse K. Krum. So, you would like to be a genius. As with all forms of greatness, a price must be paid for such an achievement. It cannot be accomplished overnight, but it is possible to awaken and develop your creative powers to a far greater extent than may seem possible as you hear these opening words. Every one of us is at some time confronted with the necessity for making important decisions, decisions which may irrevocably turn our life in one direction or another. At such times, we desperately need answers, not the facile answers of expediency, but those which spring from a wisdom in harmony with spiritual law. Such answers seem to come more readily to some individuals than to others, for they have been able, often perhaps without knowing it, to tap a level of awareness which exists in every one of us, and which, if we can establish contact with it, leads to the development of our creative potential and the deepening and strengthening of our spiritual life. This level of awareness corresponds with what some call intuition, that faculty of understanding, perception and discernment, or direct knowing, which exists at a level beyond the conscious, reasoning mind. Rooted in wholeness, intuition acts as a mirror to reflect itself into consciousness through thought. Although unfragmented and perfect at its source, this inner knowing may be distorted by the personality-centered individual. It is well, therefore, to free ourselves as far as possible from rigidities of temperament and from the conditioning of our environment. In the following excerpt from the book The Art of Inner Listening, the author relates to us her experience while discovering this technique.
Many years ago, in a time of personal trauma, I discovered the possibility of getting help from this inner level of the self. Overwhelmed by indecision and despair, I turned inward and asked, "What shall I do now?" Thinking stopped momentarily, and I listened. Suddenly, a clear, compelling thought flooded my mind, answering my question and bringing insight into my personal responsibility for the urgent need which was causing emotional and mental anguish. Thereafter, whenever threatened by especially stressful situations, or when faced by indecision and doubt, I turned within for help. If I listened intently, my mind stilled, there arose from this tranquil silence in response to my questions a degree of self-understanding through lucid, concise thought. This practice was used at first only for emergencies and was not connected with my daily meditations. Later, in 1966, participating in a meditation group interested in experimenting along these lines, I began to practice inner listening regularly. In the group situation, after each meditation, a question was asked by one or more members. Anyone wishing to take part in the exercise wrote the question, inwardly repeated it, and then listened, with eyes closed, to prevent sight-triggered thought images. Any thoughts that came into consciousness were recorded. Surprisingly, answers received in this way on a particular question, although varied in style and content, were not contradictory. We seemed to be drawing on the same source of information, with each one reacting to it in a personal and individual way. This was not automatic writing. No one heard voices, nothing mediumistic occurred. Each one was fully cognizant of his own thoughts. One began to wonder if it were really possible, through this method, to tap a depth of understanding unknown and unused by most of us. I had meditated for many years, hoping to learn eventually to still my mind. According to both religious and yogic disciplines, mental quietude is important for the attainment of understanding that reaches beyond the realm of reason. But for me, the concept of stilling the mind through meditation remained unclear, and I was far from sure what it would or would not do for me once I achieved it. I assumed it would enable me to live as a supportive, contributing member of society. However, meditation had given me a recognizable degree of emotional serenity and control, and I reminded myself that this should be compensation enough. But stillness? Peace? The harder I tried, the more remote success appeared. Mind, instead of becoming still, raced teasingly from thought to thought, defying my efforts to control it. With such a background of frustration and failure in reaching inner stillness, I now asked myself if the listening technique with which we were experimenting would enable anyone using it to still the mind. More importantly, would it result in reaching an archetypal level of intuition and creativity? The method was simple. A child could use it. Inwardly ask a question, then listen intently. Really listen. I realized that this was the same procedure that previously had proved effective in times of singular need. The only difference was the use of a notebook for recording questions and answers. I began to practice inner listening at home each morning after meditation. This proved to be rewarding in many ways. The link between inner and outer mind seemed stronger. Information which I could not recall having heard or read before flowed into my mind. In response to questions, the meanings of symbolic dreams, of ancient legends, and of sacred scriptures became clear. Personal, unresolved inner conflicts and hidden motives were revealed. I could observe them rationally, without feelings of guilt, and I felt that I was gaining more self-understanding. It was an exciting and stimulating experience. I was eager to continue this adventure into the inner space of self. It is understood that, while each of us is unique in manner of expression and even in ways of interpreting experience, all are rooted in a universal spiritual reality. And everyone who has ever given the matter conscious thought longs for a richer, fuller, and more meaningful life. I continued to perfect the technique of inner listening. As I tuned in more and more to this inner mind, I experienced deeper levels of understanding. Sometimes, in reading a book, I discovered new depths of meaning and significance. A sense of inner joy has been one of the plus values I have found in my search for self-understanding and contact with the inner levels of mind. In this quest, my questions have ranged from sublime to trivial, and even to the ridiculous. As an example, a more weighty type of question concerned the nature of truth. Is truth, I asked, changeless and eternal? We constantly speak of truth, and the need to find and know it. For what are we looking? Or is truth something that may be glimpsed, but never grasped? Does one become aware of what truth is little by little, or does it come like a flash of light or an inner awakening? Briefly, I contemplated the questions I had written, and then I stopped thinking and just listened. Listened as intently as if my very life depended upon hearing some far, distant sound. Suddenly, answers to my questions entered the threshold of consciousness, and I recorded them in my notebook. If you could take knowledge and add it to wisdom and understanding, you would begin to know something of the meaning of truth. Do not look for truth with a capital T. Search for something less elusive and of more immediate value to you. Look rather for the truth about yourself. Just how well do you know yourself? How do you feel about yourself, and how do you relate to other individuals? They, like you, have problems, fears, anxieties, frustrations, hopes, joys, and longings for completeness. you wish for understanding to discover truth? Then be aware that self-knowledge is the beginning of understanding. Without understanding, how can you expect to find truth? Many people in a vague way are looking for truth. They dream also of someday doing good in the world. Such ideas for most individuals are unformulated and tenuous, slumbering in hidden recesses of the mind. These dimly perceived longings may be expressed by wishing for money or time to use in helping people. Such wishful thoughts are of no more use than evanescent dreams. To help others, you must first have sufficient understanding to help yourself. If you can help yourself, if you can understand yourself, then you will be ready to help those who may need your help and who perchance may accept the help offered. The flow of thought stopped. It was as if some inner part of myself had spoken, not with audible words, but with clear and concise thoughts. It was as if this inner mind spoke with authority and sure knowledge. I had written the thoughts as they flowed into my outer mind. Now I read and reread what I had written in my notebook. Time seemed to stand still as I entered a state of almost reverie. The mask of maturity, for the moment, was pushed aside, and I looked at myself in retrospect from childhood to youth and on into maturity and age. Again, I turned my attention inward. Is it possible for me truly to know and understand myself? I asked. I listened, and the answer came. The personal self is a strong barrier to hold back and block the pathway to true knowledge and self-understanding. But it is possible. Personal discipline and much effort are required. Do not expect this to be an easy task. How do I begin this search for self-understanding? I inquired. You begin with self-examination of thought, emotion, and action. This brings understanding as to why you think, feel, and act as you do. If you find yourself becoming emotional about something, often trivial or inconsequential in nature, stop and inwardly ask yourself, what is the reason for this? Why am I feeling as I do? Then listen to what the inner you can tell you. This can help prevent emotional buildup with its resulting loss of vital force and energy, and may allow the inner you to reveal some hidden motive or causative factors that will help you regain emotional balance. Then I asked, are there books I could read which would be helpful? Again came an answering thought. Books have been written that can point the way and give useful hints. Systems and methodologies have been offered by many religions, philosophies, and teachers. Much is available, and some will prove helpful, but all these are but steps leading to the ocean of truth and understanding. Each one, in the end, must find his own inner awareness of truth. Into the ocean one must plunge and leave behind the stepping stones.
For more information, may we suggest the following books: The Art of Inner Listening by Jesse K. Crum, Finding the Quiet Mind by Robert Elwood, and Raja Yoga by Wallace Slater. The Theosophical Society in America welcomes your inquiries on this and other related subjects toll-free at 1-800-654-9429. That's 1-800-654-9429. Or you may write to the Theosophical Society in America, P.O. Box 270, Wheaton, Illinois, zip code 60189-0270. The toll-free number once again is 1-800-654-9429.
The Theosophical Society in America presents The Eternal Quest, a series that asks thought-provoking questions on such topics as the search for meaning, conquest of illusions, and life after death. Our program today deals with the subject of music as meditation.
What do we know about the power of sound? We know it can cause damage at high decibel ranges. At a certain pitch or frequency, it can shatter glass. It can soothe, heal, and uplift. The wisdom tradition makes some dramatic assertions about sound. Sound, it says, is a stupendous force, and when directed with spiritual knowledge, has more power than the electricity generated by a million Niagaras. Sound, it claims, may be produced of such a nature that the pyramid of Cheops could be lifted or that a dying man could be revived. Indian classical musicians, steeped in their country's true heritage, accept such ideas as a natural extension of the power of sound. For them, sound and spirit are one. Musical life and spiritual life are one. Master sound, they say, and the power of the soul is yours. The great composers of the West have talked of experiencing another dimension through music. Mozart, Brahms, and Tchaikovsky described a dreamlike state into which they entered when composing. Brahms was once asked, "Can you do anything to induce this dreamlike condition?" "Yes," he replied. "I early discovered that to obtain good results, certain conditions must be met. First of all, I have to be absolutely alone and undisturbed. Concentration to the point of complete absorption seems to be the key that unlocks the door to the soul realm, once I have the other requisites."
Richard Wagner put it like this: "There must be some indescribable inner sense, which is altogether clear and active only when the outward-facing senses are as if a dream. When I strictly neither see nor hear distinctly, this sense is at its keenest and shows its function as creative calm. I can call it by no other name. Merely I know that this calm of mine works from within to without. With it, I am at the world's center." For them all, then, the musical experience is a meditative one. Composition and performance are an act of meditation, insofar as complete concentration, absorption, and self-forgetfulness are characteristic of the experience.
But most of us are not Beethovens or Ravi Shankars. What can sound do for us? More practically, when we are listening to a piece of music, can we do anything to deepen our response? What should we do to become aware of the inner forces of sound? Can music be used for real meditation at all, or does it find its place as a healing, calming, background hum preparatory to the silence?
Physically, music can cause changes in breathing, muscular tension, heartbeat, pulse, and blood pressure. It involves both relaxation and invigoration occurring simultaneously. So we can say that if we let music act upon us as open recipients, we can slow down our generally frenetic pace and achieve a regulated or harmonized bodily rhythm. And isn't this also an outcome of meditation? Stephen Halpern, the well-known New Age musician, has measured music's effect on the nervous system. He suggests that there is music the nervous system likes to dance to. With the help of biofeedback data, muscle testing, Curlian photography, and other techniques, Halpern asserts that certain music is especially likely to heal and soothe us, and even produce a significant increase in alpha wave activity of the brain, that pattern associated with the meditative state.
Moving on to more subtle, superphysical levels, The wisdom tradition suggests that sound leaves its imprint on man's etheric body, the force field which surrounds each one of us and which conducts our vital energy. In his work with musicians in the observation of these effects, sensitive Geoffrey Hodson commented that even the blowing of a single note affected the health aura of the performer. Sound can stimulate and activate the chakras or force centers in the etheric field, and this principle is at the basis of the highly scientific use of mantras by true yogis to raise the vibratory rate of consciousness. We all know that music modifies and subtly changes our feelings. It is enormously potent and can awaken aspiration, idealism, and dreams. It inspires love, joy, vitality, and peace. Positive effects clearly also characteristic of the meditative experience. If the harmonies of music can be allowed to establish themselves as vibratory patterns in our consciousness, they will find expression, transmuted, in a harmonious personality. Using the vocabulary of the wisdom tradition, we can say not only does certain music raise the pitch and accelerate the motion of every atom in the body, but being vibratory, it sets into action the finer matter of the higher levels of our consciousness, making it easier for the spiritual dimension to impress itself upon us.
A deeper musical experience is clearly characterized by an alert mind, attentive listening, and the ability to stay with the music. If with pure concentration of mind and a pure flow of heart, we will listen fully to music and for a moment become one with it, sense the divine in it, we can be filled with its joyous energy, its lyrical sweetness, until we are that energy, that sweetness. Contemporary composers and musicologists affirm this in their own way. A masterwork, writes Aaron Copland, awakens in us reactions of a spiritual order that are already in us, only waiting to be aroused. In a biography of Richard Wagner, we find the following typical observation. Wagner's music, quote, in some mysterious way transcends the art of music alone to become a spiritual experience. The power of his music to move an audience lies in his ability to bypass the listener's intellectual and aesthetic responses and to communicate directly with the deepest recesses of the psyche. End quote. Others put it like this. There come certain high moments of response in which the listener is laid asleep in body and becomes a living soul.
Let's compare the process of meditation and the movement of artistic creation and see just where the listener, the spiritual aspirant, stands in relation to both. Consider this marvelous explanation by Lama Govinda. The hidden way that leads to the primordial source within ourselves is the path of meditation and absorption, and the vessel in which the water of life is brought up to the surface is art. The vessel may have many shapes, words, songs, forms and colors, signs and symbols, dreams and visions, or material creations. Those who remain at the source are wise. Those who return again to the world in order to share the precious elixir with others are the creative minds. But those who themselves become the vessels and give themselves to the world are the all-compassionate ones, the liberators of humanity, the enlightened ones. For the composer, then, meditation is the ground out of which his art grows. He is largely taken up with reversing the meditative process into a process of materialization. As listeners, we in our turn can reach back through that object of art, can be swept along the inward path by the power of the music, to contact at our own point the stream or pool from which the composer has drawn his creative power. More than that, we can fill the experience with our own unique life, can create, in fact, another work of art a miniature symphony, namely ourselves. This is the wisdom tradition perspective on meditation. As Lama Govinda says, we must ourselves become the vessel, the work of art, in the service of the world.
For those who feel that music and serious meditation never go together, that in fact silence is basic to meditation proper, it can be suggested that the steps are stages of meditation: attention, observation, concentration, visualization can be approached in a musical context. The beauty of the music will sweep us along the inward path with attention, observation, concentration, and absorption as natural, positive movements or steps in a stepless way. Of course, there is a world of pure abstraction where outer music is really but a distant echo of inner music, where outer sounds, physical, emotional, and mental, fade away before the one great primordial sound, the voice of the silence. But actually, meditation is not formless except in its ultimate, illimitable stages.
So music lovers and spiritual seekers, know that you may respond deeply to music without any formal musical education. That music, beautiful, magical, sacred, is beyond price in your spiritual quest. Be alert to its richness. Have faith in its power and have respect for your own instinctive choices and loves. Above all, be sensitive to the needs of your own being at all levels, and keep available programming and live music that best suits the requirements of the moment. As the famous Hungarian composer Zoltán Kodály says, there is no complete spiritual life without music, for the human soul has regions which can be illuminated only by music.
For further information, may we suggest the following books and tapes: The Esoteric Nature of Music Video, Self-Transformation Through Music, a book by Joanne Crandall, The Hidden Side of Things, a book by clairvoyant Jeffrey Hodson, and two books by Hal Lingerman, Healing Energies of Music and Life Streams, Journeys into Meditation and Music.
The Theosophical Society in America welcomes your inquiries on this and other related subjects toll-free at 1-800-654-9429. Or you may write to the Theosophical Society in America, P.O. Box 270, Wheaton, Illinois, zip code 60189-0270. Our toll-free number once again is 1-800-654-9429.